Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Tencent, TikTok and Katy Perry. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
Oh.
Offbeat that was.
It was jazzy. As ever, we're going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last 7 days, and quite a bit, actually.
Yeah.
Because
we took a holiday.
Yeah, an accidental holiday.
We didn't mean to take a holiday. We took a few weeks off. There was meant to be one of those special editions to fill the gap.
I believe it was promoted.
It was promoted. So, sorry about that. Because you know how we did those special editions for CMU's 20th anniversary?
I remember, yes.
Well, that's done.
Mm.
That's over.
Yeah.
Forget about that. But we got a brand new series of special editions.
We have.
Which people who actually read the CMU Daily. Do you think there's anyone who actually listens to the Setlist podcast and actually reads the CMU Daily? Do you think there's a cross-section there?
Me?
You?
Yeah. Well, it depends what you care. I mean, I don't tend to open the emails.
But you have to read it because you proofread it. Is
yeah.
that what you're saying?
I mean, I get the behind-the-scenes outtakes.
But we did actually mention in a CMU Daily what this special series was going to be, because it was meant to be an edition already going out. So, basically, it's the top 10 music lawsuits of all time.
Yeah.
So we have all of time
yeah.
to pick from.
Mm.
So the top 10 music lawsuits. So the first of those, it is no secret, is going to be the Blurred Lines case, because that was the one that was going to come out a couple of weeks ago, which we wrote about in the CMU Daily. Then, for technical reasons that we won't go into, didn't come out.
No.
So it's going to come out next week, I think. But as a result of that, it has been a few weeks since we last made a proper set list.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it's the summer, so not a huge amount has been happening. Although, having said that, there have been some big developments and a couple of big stories.
Yes, there have. So in terms of things we've discussed on other editions of the show already, Woodstock was finally cancelled.
Quite some time, because you remember the last proper edition set list.
I was quite cross when they cancelled. I felt they should have gone ahead with it.
But the last edition of set list that we did do a few weeks ago, we were talking about the latest developments in them trying to find a new home for Woodstock. And we were convinced when we recorded that, that by the time the podcast went out, particularly it went out a few days late, that it was all going to be cancelled and the story would be a non-story. There was at least another week
yeah.
of it maybe happening before they finally said, yeah, there ain't going to be a 50th anniversary festival
Woodstock. They got down to about 2 weeks to go, and then they went, no, we just can't do it, there's not time. And also no artists want to play it anymore.
Got to the point where not only did they not have a financial backer, a production partner or a venue, they also had no artists.
And they hadn't sold any tickets.
And they hadn't sold it. I mean, they had plenty of tickets on sale.
No, okay.
But, yes.
So at they least finally, they don't have to refund anyone.
But you felt that you'd committed so much to that saga that there should have been an actual event at the end of it.
It seemed like it might have carried through just on the sheer will of it. We talked a lot about Michael Lang's optimism that the event was going to go ahead.
Him being one of the original founders of Woodstock.
Since then, he started doing interviews where he's basically going, oh, well, it was obviously never going to go ahead.
We were hoping that it would be him and a harmonica, weren't we? 150,000 people in a field, the only field in the world that would host it, which we hadn't as yet found, and then him and a harmonica. So yeah, Woodstock 50 is not happening. That was one of the big developments since we've not been here.
Pledge went into liquidation.
So Pledge Music, which we did talk about previously, obviously the crowdfunding and pre-order platform that admitted last year that it was having financial problems, subsequently ceased operations earlier this year, owing quite a lot of artists who had used the service in the last year money. It was hoped a buyer might be found. Initially, the plan was they might just find a buyer. Then the next hope was that if they put it into administration, restructured the debts, then maybe they could find a company willing to take it out of administration. But yeah, what's happened in the last couple of weeks is that the High Court has issued an order to start winding up the business.
Yes, because actually they said they were going to go into administration at some point and then didn't for quite a long time. And all that time, us and anyone else reporting on this were saying, we don't know when that paperwork's going to be filed. They've said they're going to do it, but they haven't. Then it turned out actually in June they'd filed the paperwork to wind the company up rather than go through the administration process, which people were quite cross about, understandably.
Although Benji Rogers, the co-founder of Pledge, who had left the company before all this began, but then returned on a volunteer basis as a consultant earlier this year, and has been pretty much the only source of information about this since February, which I think is another reason why those artists who are effective are even more pissed off, because it really felt like there was just a communication shutdown once they really needed communication, and the only messages we were getting were Benji through his personal social media, not through any official channels. But he did say that they were still trying to sell the company up until about 48 hours before the court order was made to begin the winding up process. So they were still trying to find a buyer, the idea being, had they found a buyer, they would have called the liquidation off. But as a result of that court order, the company is now not in the hands of the directors of the business, but of the official receiver of this United Kingdom. And, I mean, Benji did put one sentence with a bit of optimism, maybe the official receiver will be able to find a buyer, but I mean, I think that's incredibly unlikely. What the official receiver almost certainly is doing is writing down a list of assets, working out how much money she can get for them, and then would share that money out between the creditors. But, I mean, to be pessimistic / realistic, my assumption is there won't be many assets, so there won't be much money, and there's going to be a lot of people wanting their share of that money.
There is going to be an investigation, though, so that's something.
The official receiver will investigate what went wrong and whether any regulations were breached. UK Music, the cross-sector trade body, meanwhile, is calling on the government to call on either or both the Competition and Markets Authority and the financial, whatever it's called these days, conduct thing.
what's the acronym for
Well, it changed its name, and I can never remember what it's called these days. Calling on them to maybe do an investigation, A, to see whether any laws were broken, and B, maybe there might need to be some new regulation on crowdfunding websites that hold money on behalf of people who are crowdfunding so that a similar thing can't happen in the future.
Might people go to prison?
Unlikely.
That would be exciting, wouldn't it?
The official receiver...
They could be put in a cell with the people from Viagogo who are going to prison. No one's going to go to prison.
The official receiver of...
Why can't people just go to prison?
Well, maybe we, out of all of those stories, we could pick one person and get them. Maybe that could be our new reality TV show. I'm trying to say that the official receiver on Twitter did outline their process and their powers, because quite a lot of the artists affected are in America, and they've no idea what an official receiver is. And so the official receiver confirmed that they will investigate. The power they have is to stop any of the directors of the company from being director of another company for 15 years, although that power will only exist in this country.
Yes.
And given that the financial backers in the latter part of Pledge's history are in America, I suspect they probably won't be that bothered by that. So yeah, that's the development on Woodstock and Pledge. Some other very quick things that have happened. We had another Spotify quarterly statement.
Yeah, they've got 108 million premium subscribers now. Woo!
Paying users going up. Also,
how much money they're making in profit now?
No profit.
Oh.
But the profit's over at the majors, isn't it? So obviously all the publicly listed companies put out their financial statements four times a year around about the same time. So we've had updates from Sony and Universal, and then Warner, even though they're not a publicly listed company, do a statement for reasons we won't go into. And so the three majors are all doing very well. Thank you very much. Out of the streaming boom, because Spotify now has 108 million paying subscribers and hands all the money. Not all the money, some of the money. Actually, not as much in percentage terms as it was, but quite a lot of the money over to the music industry. So these are all things that have happened over the last few weeks. The Mercury shortlist was announced.
It was, yeah.
Were you excited about this year's Mercury shortlist?
No.
You put a made-up shortlist into the Daily.
I did. I was excited about that one.
Because the Seeming Daily goes out around about 11 a.m. The Mercury shortlist goes out around about 11 a.m. on the day that it's published. Not every day. On the day it's published. And you reckon they used to give it us under embargo so that we could prepare
our... They did until a few years ago. And I think possibly some people abused that.
Abused.
Went to the bookies with it.
So we're not allowed it under embargo
so
anymore.
So no matter how often I say, but we're not going to do anything with it. I just need it so I can have it, so I can put it live when it goes out. No, so can't have it. But it's only the last couple of years that's been the case.
We were unable to report on the actual Mercury shortlist the day it came out. Did we the next day? Did we put the actual shortlist? Did we not?
No.
So instead, you made up your own list of mainly made up bands. I think the 1975 was in there.
Yeah.
Someone did say to me that while chuckling at your... Because they found it funny.
It was funny.
Your made-up list.
It was funny.
While chuckling at your made-up list...
It was very funny.
One of the things they were amused by
was
the silly made-up title you'd given the 1975 album until they saw the actual Mercury shortlist and realised, oh, that's what that 1975 album was actually called.
Yeah.
It has a quite silly name.
Yes.
So that's on the list. But Dave's going to win, so there's no point talking about the rest of it, is it? So 1975 are on there. Dave's on there. He's going to win. Let's forget about the rest. So we're not going to talk about any of those things.
No.
But the reason we kind of had this waffled at the start is to explain why we haven't been here for a few weeks, but also this edition is kind of a catch-up edition.
Yeah.
So not everything we're talking about this week has happened in the last 7 days. Some of it happened a couple of weeks ago. But these are three things that we think are of interest.
You should know about these things.
Maybe the last 3 weeks. Is it the big three from the last 3 weeks?
Probably.
Something like that.
Yeah, let's say that.
Sounds
yeah.
good. No one's going to do the maths, are they?
No. Why would anyone check?
What are the big three from the last 3 weeks in music?
Well, I'll tease you two. How about that?
Why don't you do some teasing?
Coming up later, we'll be discussing TikTok taking ICE to the Copyright Tribunal and the big Katy Perry song theft case. But first, Vivendi has announced that it is in preliminary negotiations with Chinese web giant Tencent about it acquiring a 10% stake in the Universal Music Group.
Now, regular listeners will remember that we've talked on previous editions of Setlist about...
Also, irregular listeners who listened to that episode.
That is true.
I want to be inclusive.
If you are an irregular listener who happens to
can't
listen...
Can't go around dictating who remembers what.
To the last edition of Setlist when we mentioned the fact that about a year ago, more than a year ago, Vivendi, the French water company...
Yeah.
It's not a water company anymore, but that's its history. Set up by one of the Napoleons, Vivendi, to sell water.
Well, they knew about water.
Well, I think to pipe water rather than sell it. Anyway, Vivendi is a one-time water company, now entertainment business, based in France.
I mean, it's the obvious transition.
Owns the Universal Music Group. And they let it be known, more than a year ago now, that they were going to sell up to 50% of the shares in the Universal Music Group. And then what you were alluding to is, a couple of months ago, the boss or the chair, he's actually the chair, isn't he? Not the
yes.
CEO of Vivendi, gave an interview in which he said, yep, we're still doing this. We're still going to sell up to half of the Universal Music Group. And then he explained that they wanted more money so that they could capitalize on the streaming boom and all of the opportunities in recorded music and music publishing in 2019/2020. And so they wanted somebody else's money because they're so confident about the opportunities in music that the streaming boom has brought about that they want to spend somebody else's money to exploit those opportunities.
Well, they want a lot of it, don't they?
They do want,
a lot of
quite a
money.
Lot of money. And then in the most recent quarterly statement from Vivendi, been talking about these quarterly statements these companies put out, they confirmed that now they'd hired some bankers to actually start talking to the various entities that have expressed an interest in taking some shares in Universal. And then subsequently to that, they confirmed that one of those companies was Tencent.
Yes, so there have been a lot of speculations about who might bid for a bit of Universal, with Tencent often mooted as a bidder. And those regular and irregular listeners with a memory may recall that we discussed quite some length on a recent edition why Tencent probably wasn't going to be one of the bidders, even though lots of people were saying they were. And look, now they are. So, well, we were wrong.
You know how all of our competitors on their socials are always talking about how they got predictions right?
Are they?
And here we are on our podcast admitting that we fucked up and that's why there was a missing special edition and that's why it's not been a podcast for a few weeks. And then our insightful analysis and comment about this big story on a recent edition of Setlist we're now admitting was completely wrong.
Yeah, well, it's charming to admit your faults, isn't it? I think that's why we're considered the people's music business news service.
Rather than the accurate...
I don't want accuracy.
Competent music business.
Was it entertaining?
News service.
That's all I care about.
So...
You need facts. I'll give you some facts now. That's what this is about.
Before you do your facts, I feel like I should justify what we were saying, right?
Yes.
Was that
of
the various people that had been mooted as possible bidders for a stake in Universal, one was a private equity type company.
Sure was.
Another was a big American entertainment company, Liberty Media, that also has big stakes in Live Nation and Sirius/Pandora. And then Tencent. And we were saying that we suspected that what Vivendi really wanted was somebody who would come to the table, put a lot of money on that table, and then leave the table and let Vivendi and the Universal management team get on with spending that money. And we were wondering whether Tencent, which obviously has its own Tencent music business, which it is slowly growing, certainly in China, but also beyond China, might not want to take that kind of backseat role. So that was why we were thinking that Tencent might not be the best partner for this, but they're only taking 10%.
Yes, because we'd also been working on the assumption that someone would take the full 50, which in hindsight, I'm not sure why we were assuming that.
And
I mean, Universal reckons its valuation is 30 billion euros. And sticking 15 billion euros on that table, even if it's a very big table, that's quite a lot for one company to do.
And I suppose if Tencent takes 10%, apparently there is the option for it to take another 10% at some point in the relatively near future.
Ooh, fun.
So that would be 20%. But then they are planning on...
Well done. Good maths.
Well, we said we were going to do accuracy on this edition.
All right, sorry.
And so I did some accurate maths.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had Tencent with 20%, but they are still talking to...
That doesn't work, does it? I want Tencent with 10%.
Well, I'm never going to finish this statement. What was I saying?
I don't know.
I've forgotten. I know what I was saying.
Facts. You were giving us facts.
Well, this is now opinion.
Oh, okay.
I've done the facts. The facts was the maths. And now I'm doing opinion. You were going to do facts, but let me do the opinion first.
Oh, I've got facts.
Which, if you have Tencent with up to 20%, and yep. then, because they are still talking to other potential bidders, you had that private equity company in for 15% and maybe somebody else 10%. And then Vivendi still had its 50%. Clearly, Vivendi is superior shareholder and therefore it would be in control. Whereas, had they sold Tencent, say, 45%, so it was more of a joint venture, then maybe at that point Tencent would have wanted to have more active involvement. Or maybe we weren't wrong. We were foreseeing why Vivendi and Tencent working together on Universal is going to be a complete and utter disaster.
Ooh.
So maybe we were right, but we were right ahead of our time.
Yes, we've done that before, I'm sure.
Always.
We've appeared to be wrong, but then been right.
You said you had facts. What are your facts?
Well, we already said that the valuation of Universal now 30 billion euros, according to Universal. And so it's going to be looking for up to 15 billion euros from all these investors who are going to come flocking to invest in the booming label business. But yeah, we don't know, as you've alluded to, we don't know how the other 40% is going to be divided up. 10% of it may go to Tencent, another 10% rather. So that leaves 30% to be divvied up somehow.
And they confirmed that they are still talking to other possible bidders. They said of the potential Tencent partnership that they saw beyond the money, other opportunities for Universal and Tencent to collaborate. So I suppose...
So there would be a proactive relationship there.
Yeah.
Rather than the benign one that we had predicted. I should stop saying that we were wrong about stuff.
You should stop saying that we're wrong about stuff.
That's the problem with predictions, isn't it? Everyone makes predictions, but then they never go back and say, oh, well, these predictions are all wrong. They just make more predictions. You should go back and look at your predictions and see that most things you predict are wrong.
Let's just agree that I'm right in saying that, okay, they are going to do a deal with Tencent, and okay, Tencent's going to have a proactive partnership with Universal, but it is almost certainly going to be a disaster. And if we can just agree on that, then we were never wrong about anything.
Okay.
They said that they are looking for other ways of working with Tencent, and I guess, well, I suppose we should remind ourselves and our listeners who Tencent are, or are we assuming that everybody knows? I mean, you've said Chinese web giant.
Yes, and you have said that they've got a growing music business.
And I've said they've got a growing music business.
Do you need more?
They are, of course, the major player in streaming in China.
Sure.
So
and elsewhere, because they've got a bit of Spotify equity, don't they?
They do have an
alliance. Spotify's got a bit of Tencent equity.
With Spotify. In China, they have a number of streaming services. The one that we tend to talk about most outside of China is QQ Music. But that's not the only one.
No. They have just one.
There are others. They also have a karaoke service and a live performance service. And they also do have a streaming service that operates outside of China called Jukes, which is live in a few Asian markets and, I believe, South Africa. So they're doing lots of stuff in the streaming space, particularly in China, where they are the major player, but also through the Spotify Alliance and through Jukes dabbling elsewhere. They also represent a lot of the global music catalogue within the Chinese digital market. So they are also a distributor, that weird thing that in China... They are both the service and the distributor, which means if you want to launch a rival streaming service, you have to go to your competitor in order to license a lot of the sort of the Western music Anglo-American catalogue. They also have other dabblings going on. I think they had a JV with Sony.
Mm.
Ooh, that might scupper that if they get into bed with Universal. But Tencent also have lots of other businesses as well. But when it comes to music, they are dabbling in lots of different bits of the music business. most of it, although not all of it, through the division Tencent Music, which was spun off and became a standalone business, separately listed on the New York Stock Exchange last year. So that's who Tencent are, and Universal are hoping, as well as getting Tencent's money, I mean, I'm guessing that's what they're really interested in. I suppose they had to put a bit in the press release where they said it's not just about the money, but under their breath they were probably saying it really is. But they are hoping that through the partnership they can look for opportunities for Universal artists in China, and then talent scouting within China and other emerging markets, and maybe taking talent there to the rest of the world, was some of the waffle that they put in their statement.
So that deal is not yet done. It's still subject to due diligence and all of the necessary legal documents being written up and signed off. But it does seem likely now that Tencent will own a little bit, or, you know, 10% is not a little bit really, but a chunk, say it's a chunk, of Universal Music in the relatively near future.
While we're wildly speculating and making false predictions that will almost certainly not turn out to be true.
These ones, this is different.
It has often occurred to me that ultimately, because you mentioned that Tencent already has some equity in Spotify.
I did. That's a fact.
And Spotify, obviously now listed on New York Stock Exchange, but maybe some point in the future, Spotify will come off the New York Stock Exchange and become a privately owned company again. And it has often occurred to me, if there was one company in the world who could take Spotify and make it a private company again and control it worldwide, it probably is Tencent. I mean, obviously, people would also say, well, what about Google? What about Amazon? But I think Tencent is potentially somebody who in the future might seek to take control of Spotify. Maybe once they've got a little bit of Universal, they'll try and grow that. They've got that option to increase it to 20%. Maybe at some point they're looking to take it over. With that service, Jukes, I think they are hoping to compete elsewhere in the African market, for example. Basically, what I'm predicting here is Tencent owning the entire music industry worldwide.
Cool.
It may well be that at some point in the future, it won't be Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU, looking back at last 7 days in the music business. It may be Setlist, the Tencent podcast, looking back at the last 7 days in the world of Tencent.
Okay.
Which will be the entire music industry.
Well, let's pitch it to Tencent now.
Let's.
They've got clearly got money.
Let's see. So anyway, yeah, Tencent might be buying a bit of Universal. That's the news.
Still to come, why Katy Perry is a terrible, terrible, terrible thief. But now, a story from a few weeks ago that we thought was still worth dissecting on this episode of Setlist. It's another story about a Chinese company bent on world domination. Because as TikTok tries to get licenses in place for the music it has knocking around its video sharing platform, in the UK, it's decided to take Collecting Society PRS for Music and ICE, the copyright hub that it co-owns, to the Copyright Tribunal.
It's a novel way of trying to get a license.
It is.
For your user-generated content.
It's not the usual way, but, I mean, who's to say what's right or wrong?
So TikTok!
Yeah.
I'm sick to death of talking about TikTok. Are you sick to death of talking about TikTok?
No, I don't talk about it very much.
Freaking TikTok. I do my PR training stuff, don't I, in another secret life that we don't talk about.
Yeah.
And what I like about that is it's all very recent graduates. So 3 times a year, I sit down with them, and they're my social media gauge. Okay, you guys, this is them, not you listening. You guys are you like in your very early 20s. You might be. You are allowed to listen to this podcast.
Some of you probably are, unless stats lie.
We tried to put a 25-year-old cutoff on it, but Spotify wouldn't let us. But
I thought just talking at length would put off young people, but apparently not.
Yeah, and we've tried really hard with that. Hey, we're going to start talking about the Copyright Tribunal. This is it.
Yeah.
This is the thing that
any young stragglers left.
That will clear them out once we get onto the Copyright Tribunal. I asked the latest lot of PR trainees what social media they use.
Yeah.
And their conclusion was Snapchat, old school, back in the day.
Yeah.
TikTok for children.
Yeah.
We're not children, they said. We don't use TikTok. Instagram, basically. Which I'm not surprised, is it? They were Instagram users. Although one of them was a Twitter user. There's your surprise.
It's a surprise.
And a couple
one should use Twitter.
A couple of them still monitor their Facebook feeds. They don't participate in Facebook in terms of publishing content, but they follow it. So anyway, the conclusion of that is TikTok, the popular streaming service for 9-year-olds,
yep,
has been a big talking point in the music industry in recent months,
yep,
because it's become a very important marketing platform for anybody pushing their music at 9-year-olds. But nine-year-olds all over the world. And there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
Because it's a global phenomenon. So like any of these user-generated content platforms, like Musical.ly, which is basically TikTok, because there were two platforms. There were TikTok and there was Musical.ly, and then they merged and they rebranded as TikTok. And of all of these things, as soon as they become global phenomena, the music industry... should put that on TikTok. They'd love it. The music industry always goes, hey, this is exciting, isn't it? Look at this global phenomenon, this new platform for reaching billions of nine-year-olds all over the world to excite them with our new music. Hey, marketing people, are you getting your TikTok strategies organized? Have we got a TikTok agency? What content are we creating to put out on TikTok? And then over here, usually about 6 months later, it used to be 6 years later, so I mean, we've had progress.
Yeah.
6 months later, the licensing team go, hey, hang on a second. What's this multi-billion dollar business called TikTok full of our music? Have they got any licenses? And so over the last year, as TikTok's become big news, it has started to sit down with the music industry, the record companies and the music distributors on the recording side, and of course, the pesky publishers and collecting societies on the song side, desperately trying to sort out its licenses. And that includes sitting down with ICE, which is a joint venture between PRS, the collecting society here in the UK, GAMER, the collecting society in Germany, and STIM, the collecting society in Sweden.
Yes, that's true.
So that's
Sorry,
what...
you paused like you were... I had nothing to add.
I wanted you to confirm
okay.
that what I was saying
that is
true.
That is correct.
There might be still a 19-year-old listening who was doubting what I was saying.
Okay.
So TikTok has been sitting down with ICE as well as everybody else. And so ICE does all sorts of different things. But one of the things that it does is that it represents its shareholders' repertoires when multi-territory digital services want to utilize them. So that's the Swedish songwriting repertoire that STIM controls, the German repertoire that GAMER controls, actually not the whole PRS repertoire. Because, as I'm sure we've talked about before on this podcast, when it comes to the licensing of song rights to streaming services, with Anglo-American repertoire, which would include the PRS repertoire, the big publishers, and increasingly the little publishers too, do their own deals with the streaming services, and then they bundle the accompanying PRS rights into those deals.
Yeah.
Which means that PRS only actually has to negotiate a deal itself for a portion of its catalogue. But where it does that, with multi-territory streaming deals, it allows ICE to do it alongside STIM and GAMER and various other rights owners that ICE works for. And so ICE has been sitting down with TikTok to try and negotiate a deal in just the same way the majors have, and I assume all the other collecting societies in the world have. But seemingly, the negotiations haven't gone as well as either side would like.
Well, no.
Hence...
well, as previously stated, Copyright Tribunal.
Hence Copyright Tribunal.
Yeah, TikTok's decision to go down the Copyright Tribunal route does suggest that ICE was driving a harder bargain than it expected in terms of the rates that it's expected to pay. Part of that would probably be because it being seen as a marketing platform, it's tried to factor promotional value into that deal making. And that sort of negotiating tactic only tends to work with labels and distributors, which are more involved with artist marketing. When you're talking to people who are just involved in deciding how much money you owe, they're not so interested, because that's not what they do.
Yeah, it's certainly true across the board, isn't it, that any service who is trying to convince a music company that they should offer more favourable rates or that they should do a more multi-layered deal where maybe the upfront costs or the minimum guarantees are lower because of the promotional value of having your music on a platform. And obviously YouTube have tried that, Facebook have tried that. All the user-generated content platforms that have bothered to try and get licensing deals will always talk about the marketing value of having your content on those services. And you know, it's fair enough. There is a marketing value. But as you say, yeah, if you're talking to labels and distributors who are generally closer to the artist marketing, then they may be swayed by that. They're not going to be completely swayed by it at all. But you can put
certainly
it into...
Certainly not to the extent that you as the digital service will be hoping.
But when you start talking to publishers and collecting societies, generally speaking, they're much more, well, we're not involved in artist marketing. We don't really care about the promotional value. We just want the best possible rate for our songwriters. And I suppose because you have started to get some record companies that are also publishers, particularly with user-generated content type services like TikTok, they have started to bring their publishing and their recording catalogues together when they're doing their negotiations. Now, if you're Sony, Universal or Warner, You can only bring your Anglo-American catalogue to the table for reasons we won't go into right now. But that is starting to happen, as I say, particularly with services like TikTok. So it may be that when you're talking to Universal, Sony, Warner, and you're getting some publishing as part of those deals, that you can use the promo line. But the minute you start talking to people who are predominantly publishers, so they're not involved in recordings, or the vast majority of their business is songs, not records, or you're talking to collecting societies who aren't involved in recordings in any way, shape, or form, then you're going to find that the promo line has pretty much zero currency at the table. So we don't know. This is speculation.
Yeah.
But that might be one of the reasons why TikTok's first battle in the licensing domain is against a collecting society, or in this case, a hub representing multiple collecting societies, rather than against a record company or even a sort of a corporate music publisher.
So the UK's Copyright Tribunal can intervene when the music industry licenses via the collective licensing system, and it exists to allay the competition law concerns that are raised by the collective licensing approach, which we have discussed many times on this show. But this is the first time that ICE, as a representative of society rights, has ever been taken to tribunal. And it's in fact more than a decade since a digital platform has taken that route against PRS in the UK.
Yeah. So I warned you that we would be talking about the ins and outs and intricacies of the Copyright Tribunal that exists under UK copyright law. So as you say, it exists because the minute the music industry starts licensing as one through a collecting society, so on the recording side, PPL, when it's negotiating with, say, a radio station, it's representing pretty much all the recordings.
Yeah.
Because it represents all of the UK record company and artist recordings, and then through reciprocal agreements with equivalent societies all over the world, the global catalogue as well. And then PRS the same on the song side.
Starts looking a little bit monopoly-y.
Yeah.
Monopoly-ish.
Monopoly-ish. Yeah. Monopoly-ish. Let's go with that. Cartel trading is another thing you might say. Because if you control all the recordings, or all the songs, and of course, when it comes to public performance, pubs, clubs, bars, cafes, PPL, PRS now work together on licensing.
Yeah.
So that's like all the songs and all the recordings. Yeah, as a licensee, you might say, well, hang on a second, these guys have got a monopoly over all songs, all recordings, all music, and they could exploit that monopoly to be unreasonable and say to me, let's say you're a radio station, a music radio station, they could say, well, hang on a second, you're a music radio station, try operating without any music. So we'll have £1 billion, please.
Yeah.
And to stop that from happening, where collective licensing applies, you have regulation of the collective licensing system to overcome those potential monopoly issues. Now, quite what that regulation is and how it works varies hugely from country to country. So in some countries, traditionally, there's been very light regulation of collective licensing. That's been true in a lot of European countries, although European law has added a new layer of regulation in all EU member states. But then in some other countries, and particularly the Anglo-American markets, there is some tighter regulation. I would say the tightest regulation is in the US, but here in the UK, we have this thing called Copyright Tribunal, which is basically a court where if you're a licensee and you feel that PRS or PPL are being unreasonable in the money they are asking, the rates they're asking, in order to access their catalogue, then you can go to Copyright Tribunal. Both sides then present their arguments, and a judge decides. And a judge says, okay,
it's a bit like a court.
This is going to be the deal. This is going to be the rate. Actually, what usually happens is after Copyright Tribunal, negotiations continue behind the scenes and the rate that's actually used is not the rate set in court. But crucially, the licensee can fall back on whatever the judge decides. So Copyright Tribunal is there. Whenever PRS or PPL are involved in licensing here in the UK, it's always an option that a licensee can take their dispute to this court. But you mentioned, yeah, in the digital space, it's not been that common. The digital services have taken, I mean, it wouldn't be PPL because in the main, PPL doesn't license digital services on the recording side. The labels all do that through direct deals. But on the publishing side, PRS has traditionally licensed digital services, originally completely, whereas now for multi-territory services, they would only be representing that bit of the PRS catalogue that isn't part of direct deals being done elsewhere. But we haven't generally seen many digital services take PRS to Copyright Tribunal. There was the hilarious dispute that almost got to Copyright Tribunal. In the end, most of it was settled out of court. In the very early days of iTunes, the original digital pie debate as to how much of the iTunes money, so the 99 pence per track, how much of that should go to the publisher,
yeah,
and the songwriter through the song write element of the download. And there was a big dispute about whether or not the CD rates should just be applied to digital, or whether actually the publishers and the writers should be getting more. Obviously, that debate has rumbled on ever since. And that almost went to Copyright Tribunal. And had it done so, it would have created a slightly crazy scenario where, in essence, because the labels wanted the CD rate to be applied and the publishers didn't, that you kind of would have ended up with a court hearing where on one side there would be representatives for Sony Music, Universal Music and Warner Music, and on the other side there would be representatives for Sony ATV, Universal Music Publishing and Warner Chappell, all arguing it out. So that would have been amusing. I say, in the end, most of that was settled out of court. But I think that's the last time a digital service has been involved in a copyright tribunal hearing. And so if this does get all the way to tribunal, well, it will throw up some interesting questions. I say interesting. I mean interesting to me. I don't know about anybody else in the world. I presumably they would be interesting for PRS, ICE, Gamer, Stim and TikTok.
Yeah.
So one interesting question is, we've said Copyright Tribunal exists to overcome the monopoly concerns of collective licensing, because under traditional collective licensing, PRS comes to the table with pretty much all the songs in the world. And so you either get a PRS license or you don't use songs. So we need Copyright Tribunal to overcome the competition law concerns. Whereas with streaming, when PRS comes to the table, okay, yes, because it's part of ICE, other rights are being included in there. But PRS is not bringing, well, even its own full catalogue. It's only bringing a portion of its own catalogue. It certainly isn't claiming to represent all of the other collecting society catalogues around the world in these license negotiations. So I would argue that once you take the Sony ATV, Anglo-American rights, Universal, Warner, etc. out, and you've got what PRS has left, I don't really see where the monopoly issue is. Now, I have no idea whether or not this will be a line that PRS, Stim, Gamer and ICE will take.
I mean, it sounds like it might.
But I don't think there's a monopoly issue. So therefore, does Copyright Tribunal even have jurisdiction? Now, it is true that with the Swedish repertoire and the German repertoire, actually Stim and Gamer do still have a virtual monopoly on their members' rights, because those songs are not subject to direct deals being negotiated by the publishers. But then there's an element of, but if your issue really is with Gamer, because let's face it, the one collecting society.
That's the one it's going to be, isn't it?
That digital services have traditionally had issues with is Gamer in Germany. If your issue is with Gamer, then sue them in Germany. Except, traditionally, the regulation of collective licensing in the UK has been much stricter than the collective licensing elsewhere in Europe.
Well, yeah, so TikTok might have had a little look at what happened with YouTube in Germany and thought, nah.
Let's see if we can pursue this through the UK courts. So anyway, I don't know what will happen with all of those technicalities if and when this gets to court. Obviously, negotiations will continue behind the scenes to try and get a deal in place between TikTok and ICE. In the meantime, both sides have issued statements, although they're not statements that give a huge amount away, except that you sort of sense, I'm probably paraphrasing here, it kind of comes down to TikTok saying the songwriters are being greedy, and ICE is saying TikTok just doesn't want to pay the going rate. And so it's almost a classic standoff between rights owner and streaming service.
So yeah, ICE, in the red corner, said the TikTok platform is unlicensed and ICE is disappointed an agreement for the use of millions of musical works belonging to the songwriters, composers and publishers we represent has not been reached before this point. We look forward to representing our rights holders' interests and securing appropriate value for the vast scale of usage of their repertoire on the platform. Our aim is that by following this legal process, TikTok will agree a license that fairly reflects the value of our rights holders' music. Then TikTok said, TikTok is an exciting way for songs and emerging artists to gain exposure and break through with a wide and varied audience.
Did their voice go squeaky like that?
Yes. As a platform for unique and original creative content, we place high value and respect upon intellectual property rights, and we work closely with music rights holders to protect a library of sound on the platform which is available for users to infuse in their own short videos. As part of this, we have been in active and extended negotiations with ICE. We have asked the UK Copyright Tribunal as a neutral third party to help us reach a reasonable outcome. We look forward to continuing the conversation with ICE and reaching an agreement that furthers the opportunity for artists and songwriters on the platform. So they're sort of saying slightly different things there, aren't they? ICE is relishing seeing the legal process in action. And TikTok, all it wants is to just have a nice chat. And it doesn't understand why this has all got so nasty.
Well, it's got nasty because it filed a copyright tribunal action.
But it just wants to just. We look forward to continuing the conversation with ICE. They just want to sit down and have a chat.
For some people,
ICE is just making it difficult.
Legal process
by asking for money.
For asking to be paid when their songwriters' music's used. Yeah, those pesky songwriters wanting to be paid. But for some people, legal process is a fun chat.
Yeah.
So maybe there's more joined up thinking here than we think.
What looks like differences, are they actually similarities?
No. So, yeah, that's all interesting. As I say, if it gets copyright tribunal, will those questions I have raised be answered? We will see. My gut instinct is it probably won't get to copyright tribunal, and eventually a deal will be done, and then both sides will issue statements saying what a great platform TikTok is and how ICE are fantastic partners representing the interests of so many fantastic songwriters that TikTok wants on its platform. That's my prediction.
It's almost like you've seen this sort of thing happen before.
In fact, I could write the press release for them if they want. But from a legal perspective, let's see it in court. That would be interesting.
And finally, let's talk about Katy Perry thieving six whole notes off a God-fearing Christian rap act. I mean, surely all Christian rap acts are probably God-fearing. I'm not sure needed that qualifier.
Some of them are Eminem-fearing.
Right.
But most of them God-fearing.
They fear Eminem, but they rap about Christ.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what I've heard.
Now, this is probably the biggest music business story since the last edition of Setlist, which obviously so we're putting it as the and finally slot, because it's the latest in a long line of song theft legal battles, which in this case has resulted in Katy Perry, Dr. Luke, Max Martin, and some others being found liable for copyright infringement and being ordered to hand over $2.7 million in damages.
Yes, this is another headline-grabbing song theft lawsuit like the big Blurred Lines case that we have that special edition coming up on, and the ongoing Stairway to Heaven case that is still rumbling through the appeals court. But this one involves Katy Perry hit Dark Horse. It's a pretty long-running case that began, it began years ago.
Yes, it's a 2013 song, and the lawsuit was filed in 2014, I think.
Yeah, so it's been rumbling through the system for a very long time. Usually with these cases, the cliche line on Setlist is, this will never get to court.
But it did get to court. That's what we're talking about, the trial now.
Exactly.
I think have we not made that clear?
One of the reasons why the Blurred Lines case was so interesting, and of course the Stairway to Heaven case, was because they did get to court and pop stars testified, and that is also true of this.
Yeah.
Because this case went to court last month, and along the way, both Katy Perry and one of her collaborators, Dr. Luke, and a Christian rapper you've never heard of, all testified in court over the allegation that the hit Dark Horse plagiarized a track called Joyful Noise, which was released several years before Dark Horse by a Christian rapper called Flame, whose real name is Marcus Gray.
It is. Now, this isn't exactly the same as the Blurred Lines case because he's not saying they intentionally set out to rip off his track. He reckons Katy Perry and Dr. Luke subconsciously infringed. They heard his track playing in all the many places that it played, and it was so catchy and great that it wormed its way into their heads. And then one day they went into the studio and they went, oh, I've just made a song. I just fashioned that song out of thin air. I made that up, but they didn't. It was their subconscious writing the song for them by just playing back something they'd already heard.
Yeah, subconscious copyright infringement. So, of course, in order to prove that, this Marcus Gray and his team had to prove either Katy Perry or Dr. Luke, or there were other collaborators on Perry's track, because as is always the way, a multitude of people are involved in writing these songs.
Yes, in fact, Dr. Luke, when he testified, said that it was based on a beat that Circuit had created, and then he'd embellished it, and then Perry had come in and heard that and added her vocals, and so that was how the song was built.
So,
a little insight into the songwriting process there.
Marcus Gray had to prove that one of those three people, or one of the other people around them, had definitely heard Joyful Noise before they started work on Dark Horse. Hence why we had a week of Katy Perry and Dr. Luke and their friends taking to the witness stand, all to declare, we've never heard of this guy, we've never heard of this song, Christian rap. Do you think we're listening to Christian rap? And Dr. Luke was saying, the world of pop music that he's in and the world of Christian rap, they're so far apart, they're so different, The idea that he could ever have been exposed to this record was just ridiculous. I'm paraphrasing slightly, but that's basically
that is
what they
were, said, yeah.
What they were saying.
Not the quote, but yeah, he did say there's no way that our worlds would have crossed over. Although, of course, Katy Perry did start out as a Christian artist, so there can be some crossover.
And she has been hanging out with nuns recently in another court case.
Yeah, I mean, not sociably.
No, but she's been in court with nuns.
I mean, so antisocial, one of them died.
When she was trying to buy an old convent. That's
not,
another bit
that wasn't. I wasn't suggesting Katy Perry killed a nun before anyone writes in.
Another Katy
Although,
Perry case.
The other nun did claim that. Anyway, that's a whole different case.
It's a different... We've got our Katy Perry case files mixed up.
Right, song theft.
Nothing to do with convents being bought. No
Katy
nuns.
Katy Perry got up in court. She said, I'd never heard this song. There's no way I subconsciously infringed it because I had no idea who this guy is. In fact, I mean, Dr. Luke's testimony was that she came in and added her vocals after the music that they're being accused of ripping off had already been written. So she wasn't even involved in that bit of the track.
Of course... The other element of a case like this, beyond proving that somebody involved in Dark Horse had heard this track to be subconsciously influenced by it, is having Marcus Gray et al. Prove in court that the two songs are even similar, that there even is a rip-off having occurred.
They are.
They are similar.
There are some notable similarities.
But as is always the case with cases like this, sort of cases, wasn't it? As is always the case with cases like this,
that's all right. Like this case.
This case.
Cases like this case.
In this case, with cases like this, it's always the case
yes.
that the way in which the two tracks, the two songs are similar, are often little musical elements that are often repeated. And the defendants will always say, well, those little elements are found in a multitude of songs and tracks that have been released over the last 100 years. They're just the building blocks of music. They can't possibly be protected by copyright because if we're saying that once this guy had used this particular beat in a track, he now owned the copyright in that and no one else could use the same beat, that would be copyright getting out of control, the creative process ruined. These are all the classic arguments you wheel out, and they were all wheeled out during this case.
So, yes, the main element of this case was that there was one six-note phrase, 4 C notes and 2 B notes, that loop throughout both tracks. And that's the bit, certainly, that Katy Perry's side is particularly focused on. I mean, there's also the fact that they both have the same opening line, and not as part of the core song, but as kind of a spoken word introduction. So in Flames' track, it starts, "You know what it is? I love it. Yeah." That's the words of his featured rapper, Lecrae. In the case of Dark Horse, featured rapper Juicy J says, "Yeah, you'll know what it is, Katy Perry. Juicy J, let's rage." But the C there, they both say, "You know what it is." And that, normally in cases like this, we go and listen to both tracks and go, yeah, they're similar because they just sound like songs. But in this case, I did think, well, that was remarkably similar.
So you're going on the lyrical
so
similarity.
I think send them to jail.
Send Katy Perry to jail over this song.
Although they are very similar elements, but they are quite common elements of a lot of songs. And the phrase that Katy Perry and Dr. Luke were accused of ripping off, I mean, it's very, very basic.
The musical phrase rather than the lyrical phrase.
No, the musical phrase, it's not the most complicated thing that anyone's ever come up with.
In fact, Dr. Luke said that if we were to suggest that musical phrase was protected by copyright, so songwriters now couldn't use it without getting permission from this guy, it would be the equivalent of telling an author that they had to write a book without using the words and, the, and a.
Which it's not,
would be quite difficult.
It would be difficult, but I mean, it's not the same as that, is it?
Is it not?
No, because you can write a song without using that musical phrase. So it's not the same as that at all.
Well, I suppose that's just as well, given the outcome of this whole thing.
Yes, because despite Perry and Luke being adamant that they'd never heard Joyful Noise, and that six-note musical phrase couldn't possibly be protected by copyright, the jury ultimately sided with Gray, ruling that Dark Horse did indeed infringe the copyright in Joyful Noise. And then just a few days later, they awarded Gray and his collaborators $2.7 million in damages.
Yeah, quite a big damages bill there. It was, perhaps unsurprisingly, less than what Gray and his team wanted. But it has to be said, quite a lot more than the Katy Perry team reckoned they were due. I mean, obviously, the Katy Perry team reckon they're due nothing.
Yeah.
Because they don't think there was any infringement.
I mean, rightly.
What you were saying was...
I may have indicated that I was on the fence about this or on one side or the other. It's stupid, isn't it? It's just stupid.
But they were saying, even though we don't accept there was an infringement, if there was an infringement...
Which there wasn't.
We don't think that six-note phrase had that big an impact on this being a hit record. And the lawyer guy for the Perry side kept saying, what makes a Katy Perry track a hit is Katy Perry, not any of the musical notes that go into it. Although,
ringing endorsement for everyone else involved.
Well, as part of the damages bit of this case, they did list of the 40-odd million that they reckon this track made, what portion went to everybody. And it has to be said, although the record label, which is Universal's capital, got most of the money, Dr. Luke and Max Martin did pretty well out of it as the producers and co-writers of the track. And yet Katy Perry's lawyer seems to be saying what they do is irrelevant.
Yeah.
Whether or not they do something original or they nick something off some Christian rapper, it's kind of irrelevant. So yes, there was a big conversation about what contribution the stolen bit, we don't have to say allegedly because a court of law says it was stolen, what the stolen bit did for that track, for Dark Horse. So what percentage of profits should go to Marcus Gray et al. Was part of the conversation. And obviously, well, I think it ended up being that the Marcus Gray side were saying that we think Marcus Gray should get about 45% of the profit. And then Katy Perry's side were going for 5%. So as you can see, quite a difference.
It was they weren't exactly in sync on that.
So it was somewhere in the middle in the end, the figure that was done. Of course, once you start talking about percentage of profits, there's then the question of, well, what were the profits?
Yes, because, in fact, Capital insisted that it had spent most of the $31 million it made from the track on making and marketing the record. You could argue that's what makes the Katy Perry track a hit. But most of it, they reckon they spent on Perry's clothes and hair care.
That's an unfair misrepresentation of what the lawyer said. But he did list how much they'd spent on the clothes and hair care. She'd done, I think, the VMAs and two of the late night telly shows. Oh no, Saturday Night Live and one of the talk shows. And he was, for some reason, going through how much they'd spent on stylists and hairdressers for those free appearances. Because, he said, everyone expects Katy Perry to be wearing all the latest clothes.
Have all the latest hair.
Have all the latest hair. And so Capital has to spend all of its money. I'm not sure it was all of the 30 million, I have to be honest. But that's what the record label were trying to say.
I don't know, hairdressers do keep putting their prices up.
They do, it's true. Capital was basically trying to say, we spent all that money on marketing and making the record. So even if you are saying that there was copyright infringement here, even though clearly there wasn't, and even if you are saying that 45% of the profits should go to Marcus Gray, even though it should be 5%, there weren't any profits anyway, was almost what they were saying. But the jury did not...
What a great business to be in.
...concur. And so, yeah.
I can see why Tencent wants to get in on it.
The jury gave Marcus Gray and his collaborators, he had collaborators too, just not collaborators you've heard of, so we're not going to mention their names. he gave them...
That's not very nice.
2.7 million of those American dollars.
Oh yeah, I know of them.
Is what they're going to hand over. Except, of course, this was, within the music community, quite a controversial ruling.
Well, as previously stated, really stupid. Why do they put these things in front of juries?
Because it's America and they're
stupid. How many times? Don't ask people for their opinions. They're all idiots.
So obviously the Perry side are going to appeal. It was widely criticised within the music industry, mainly on my LinkedIn profile for some reason. I posted a link to our coverage of it. And a debate ensued between the American music industry on this. But yeah, it does seem almost certain that the Katy Perry side are going to appeal. Some quite bold statements already from her lawyer.
Yes, that lawyer, Christine LaPera, told Law 360 that the writers of Dark Horse consider this a travesty of justice. The defendants now plan to vigorously fight both the infringement ruling and the damages bill.
So I don't think this is the end of this story.
I think once it gets up the chain, juries are cut out of the process, aren't they? Once you get into appeals and Supreme Court appeals, potentially.
It is true. Once you get into the appeals process, it will be judges looking at this.
Well, that didn't work for the Blurred Lines case.
It did not
work. Oh, little spoiler there for the next bonus episode.
The judges held up the ruling in the Blurred Lines case, although that was on some technicalities about American copyright law, wasn't it? Where this case...
Well, I'm not going to tell you anymore. You have to listen.
Was
next week.
Much more on... Well, it was a subconscious infringement case.
This one.
This one.
Yes.
And there was quite a lot of chatter in that conversation about... Because subconscious infringement sometimes seems a bit odd. I mean, it's definitely there in the law. You can subconsciously infringe. But, as I've said, in a subconscious infringement case, you need to prove that the other people had definitely heard your track. And that is where I think in this ruling, they set the bar quite low in saying, well, it was on YouTube.
You must have listened to YouTube. And did it have YouTube on in the background?
And it had a few million plays on YouTube, they were saying.
It's loads.
But as Katy Perry's lawyer said, I mean, that isn't loads in the context of YouTube. And it's not like it being on daytime radio, where there is a high chance that people will have heard it without even realising they're hearing it. I mean,
yeah.
You have to go to a YouTube video and watch it. So I think that's where the bar was set quite low in this judgment. But what will be argued in appeal, we will see, I guess, because this almost certainly will get to appeal.
I think the lawyer will just stand up and just shout stupid until she's told to stop.
That didn't work for Robin Thicke's lawyers, did it?
It's not quite what they did.
It's not quite what they did. It is true. Maybe they should have done. Maybe the story we're going to tell on the next setlist special would be very different if that is what they had done. So yeah, the next setlist is going to be a special. And then, I can't remember if we're back the week after that. I'm kind of losing track.
I think, yeah.
There might be a proper edition and then another special edition. And then it'll be Christmas. Is it not nearly Christmas?
Jumping ahead a little bit, but yeah.
Feels like it's nearly Christmas.
Once you get past the summer, it's all... You're just waiting for Christmas, aren't you?
This podcast has been going long enough. I think it might now be Christmas. I don't know. Shall we finish?
Okay, well, that is all we've got time for this week. If you want to listen to that special edition on the Blurred Lines trial, which, let me tell you now, you do, because it's very good, you should subscribe to receive it automatically. If you go to your podcast app of choice and hit the subscribe button on the setlist page, then that'll all happen, and it'll be very exciting for you. But yes, that's it for now. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook, produced by Matt Peaty, edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.